Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 457, titled Three's a Crowd, Terrorism in the Triple Border Area. This is being recorded on April 25th of the year 2004. Within a week or so of the airing of this program, there will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of For the Record 457 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Spitfire List is one word. Frequently, as has been the case in particular with For the Record's 454, 5, and 6, I include material in the descriptions that I did not have time to include in the original broadcast. So given the pedantic nature of the programs themselves, and given the limitations of time, which happily don't exist with regard to the descriptions, please do take advantage of those written descriptions. They're an invaluable resource. Again, www.spitfirelist.com. The Spitfire website is now equipped with a search function to help you locate material within the descriptions. Also, be aware that the Spitfire website now features Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, the very important text by the late heroic Paul Manning. It's a staple, a mainstay of these broadcasts, and the entire book is now available for download for free on the Spitfire website. It's being converted from Adobe Acrobat to HTML as I speak. Sister station WFMU-FM, the heroic WFMU, is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, DaveEmory. Older programs are available for download only, also on Real Audio, at a longer URL linked to both the wfmu.org/Dave Emery website and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Now, the title of the broadcast, Three's a Crowd, Terrorism in the Triple Border Area, refers to the triple border area in Latin America where Paraguay, Brazil, and Argentina all meet. That area has long been a sort of a focal point of various clandestine activities, including organized crime, money laundering, smuggling, drug traffic, arms traffic, and so forth. Within the last 10 years, it has become a major training ground and breeding ground for international terrorism, Islamic terrorism in particular. We're going to take a look in this broadcast at some significant evidentiary tributaries running between September 11th and the Triple Border Area, and equally important concerns some networking that appears to have been going on between various terrorist groups, including Sunni and Shia Islamic terrorist groups. Sunni and Shia are deadly enemies in other parts of the world, but not in the Triple Border Area, where some of these terrorist elements seem to be working together. Perhaps even more significantly, other terrorist groups, Western terrorist groups, including American white supremacist and neo-Nazi terrorist groups, are not only working in the same area, but they appear to be working hand in glove with some of the Islamist elements, and there appear to be some neo-Nazi slash white supremacist elements that are connected to the events in and around September 11th. We've spoken about that in a number of broadcasts. I touched on it in For the Record program number 456, among others. Again, please check the descriptions for these broadcasts at www.spitfirelist.com. This broadcast is going to be based on a very important article that appeared in Vanity Fair magazine from December of 2002. A tip of the hat to a member of the listening audience who researched this for us. This article is called Terrorism's New Geography, Al-Qaeda's Links to Triple Border, where Argentina, Paraguay, and Brazil meet, have gone largely ignored, but the U.S. But at training camps in this jungle region, intelligence sources say, a nightmare alliance of terror, Hamas, Hezbollah, IRA, Colombian rebels, Basque separatists, and even Aryan nations, is unified by hatred. That's the subtitle to this broadcast. It was authored by Sebastian Junger, a very well-respected and well-known journalist. Again, Terrorism's New Geography by Sebastian Junger from Vanity Fair's issue of December of 2002. We've touched on some of these elements in other broadcasts in the past, including broadcasts about the AMIA bombing in Manzer el-Qasar, such as FTR 109. We've also talked about some of the networking that we're going to be looking here at here in broadcasts about the Oklahoma City bombing, FTR 443 and 447, also FTR programs number 328 and 330, among others. I want to note, too, at one point, that in the discussion of Manzer el-Qasar, there's reference to his involvement in the Condor missile development, a joint Argentinian and Iraqi missile development program. We looked at that in, for the records, 155 and 384, and in turn looked at the links of the Underground Reich and the Bormann Organization to the development of that weapon system, as well as nuclear weapons programs by Argentina and Brazil, as well as Iraq. In the descriptions for this program, there will be more detailed annotations, so we're just going to proceed into this article, and periodically I will stop briefly in order to note some of the tangential connections of some of the various subjects that should be pursued in connection with this. From Terrorism's New Geography by Sebastian Junger, Vanity Fair, December of 2002, we read about Ramzi bin al-Shib. He was one of the people implicated in the September 11th plotting. He was not able to get into the United States per se, but was part of the cell that helped to arrange September 11th, and more about him as follows. The 30-year-old bin al-Shib was a major catch. He was from a remote region of Yemen and had gone to Germany in 1995, pleading for political asylum from persecution in Sudan. He was denied, but managed to re-enter the country with a student visa, and by 1998, he had moved into an apartment at 54 Marienstrasse in Hamburg with Mohammed Atta, the man thought to be the leader of the September 11th hijackers and two other al-Qaeda operatives. Bin al-Shib neither worked nor regularly attended classes at the school where he had enrolled. Instead, he spent his time going to the Al-Quds Mosque, where the virulent, anti-Western sermon seemed to have inspired him to dedicate his life to what he understood to be jihad. Bin al-Shib applied to a flight school in the United States, was accepted, and applied for U.S. entry visas at least four times, but was rejected. As a Yemeni, he was considered a high risk to overstay his visa. Apparently unable to join Atta and the others for the hijackings, he instead became a logistics coordinator. He wired money, ran errands, and maintained a base of operations in Hamburg. In January of 2000, in Kuala Lumpur, he attended a meeting believed to have been related to the upcoming attack on the USS Cole, and in July of 2001, he met Atta and four others in Tarragona, Spain, to make arrangements for September 11th. On September 5th, 2001, he went back to Spain with a return ticket to Germany for 2 weeks later, but the ticket was never used. Investigators believe he went to Afghanistan and then to Pakistan. He certainly wound up there, and parenthetically, he was captured there in 2002. But there is another possibility. According to sources in Argentinian intelligence, bin al-Shib has known, confirmed contacts with a Lebanese businessman working in Ciudad del Este, Paraguay, and Foz do Iguaçu, Brazil. The two cities are in an area known as Triple Border, where Brazil, Argentina, and Paraguay converge. Triple Border has a large Lebanese expatriate population, a thriving black market in cheap electronics, and a 10-year history of Islamic extremism. It's possible that bin al-Shib, instead of going to Afghanistan to fight and die in a hopeless struggle against the United States, went to Triple Border. If not, he almost certainly had associates who did. Brazilian authorities have intercepted numerous phone calls from clandestine telephone exchanges in Triple Border and Afghanistan. And last year, a CNN reporter in Kabul found a large tourist poster from Triple Border at an al-Qaeda safe house. Quote, "The day after September 11th, the CIA dispatched a team down there," says Magnus Ronstorp, director of the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at the University of St. Andrews in Fife, Scotland. Quote, "For me, the tri-border area is the Hilton of Islamic extremism. It's one of the most lucrative safe havens in the world, and it's been on the radar since the early 1990s, but no one has done anything about it," unquote. By the way, before we continue with this article, I want to note that there were at least two forewarnings of the September 11th attacks that came out of the Triple Border area, one from a potential recruit to some of the attacks who basically rolled over and blew the whistle, and another from an Argentinian intelligence infiltrator into this milieu. And again, note there were at least two forewarnings of September 11th that came out of the Triple Border area, and as was the case with so many different warnings from so many different areas, they came to naught, partially, no doubt, due to error, and partially, I'm convinced, due to the deliberate sabotaging of counter-terrorist efforts. Continuing. The remarkable lapse of American efforts to monitor al-Qaeda in Triple Border can be traced back to 1999, when relations between the CIA and Argentina's Secretariat of State Intelligence, or SIDE, suffered a complete breakdown. Several years earlier, the CIA had asked its counterparts at SIDE to infiltrate the Triple Border area in order to obtain information on Islamic extremist groups there, particularly on Hezbollah. The operation was called Centauro, unquote. The report, which was handed over in 1999, contained information that the CIA rejected as implausible, according to SIDE. An intelligence insider believes the CIA did pursue the information, but encountered resistance higher up, quote, I was personally involved in tracking terrorists to Triple Border, says ex-CIA officer Robert Baer. We were aware it was a platform for them to go after the U.S., unquote. SIDE agents had identified al-Qaeda operatives in Triple Border, recorded meetings of Islamic extremists in the mosques in Ciudad del Este and in Foz do Iguaçu, infiltrated moles into terrorist groups, detailed al-Qaeda indoctrination and fundraising efforts, and provided evidence of terrorist training camps on the Paraguay-Brazil border. According to Argentinian news sources, the CIA accused SIDE of retaliating by leaking a photograph of then-CIA Buenos Aires station chief Ross Newland to a local newspaper in January of 2001. Several months later, Newland returned to the United States and the CIA severed almost all ties with SIDE, dumping it instead into the hands of the FBI, which also failed to exploit the information. The Centauro operation languished until the September 11th attacks, when the CIA rediscovered its interest in Triple Border. Bin al-Shib's capture was announced the night of September 12th, but I didn't hear about it until the next morning because I was on a flight to Buenos Aires. I was going there to meet with a former Argentinian intelligence agent named Mario Aguilar Risi, R-I-S-I, who claimed to know a lot about Bin al-Shib. I knew Risi through a mutual contact. All summer, Risi had been telling me that he had tracked Bin al-Shib and other top al-Qaeda and Hezbollah operatives to Brazil and Paraguay, and he had surveillance photos to prove it. It was a dramatic story, maybe overly so, and the 55-year-old Risi himself was already a rather dramatic story in his own right. He had spent several years in jail, two of them for extortion, but was known in Argentina for having had foreknowledge of two deadly Buenos Aires car bombings suspected to have been the work of Hezbollah. Now, he claimed that he had hard intelligence on al-Qaeda activity in Triple Border. Specifically, he said he had recently tracked Ramzi bin al-Shib to São Paulo, Brazil, before the terrorist left the country under a false passport. In Brazil, Bin al-Shib had supposedly met with a top Hezbollah terrorist named Imad Muganaya at the Maksud Plaza Hotel. The Maksud Plaza Hotel is one of the fanciest hotels in São Paulo, and when the terrorists left by the front door, according to Risi, a former Argentinian police officer snapped a photo of them. The photographer was named Alejandro and worked for Risi gathering counterterrorism intelligence. Risi claimed that the photo of Bin al-Shib was in a secure location in Triple Border, along with surveillance photos and tapes of other terrorists. And if I didn't believe him, I was welcome to come down and see for myself. By the way, we talked about Imad Muganaya in For the Record program 328, among others. Continuing. Terrorism established itself beyond a doubt in Argentina in the early 1990s. Around 10 o'clock on the morning of July 18, 1994, a white Renault Traffic packed with 600 pounds of ammonium nitrate, a fertilizer, and fuel exploded next to the Argentine-Israeli Mutual Association in downtown Buenos Aires. The explosion was so powerful that it brought down most of the seven-story building. The driver, no one knows who he was, disappeared. 86 of the 100 or so people then in the building died in the blast. A woman who happened to be crossing the street just before the explosion had nearly been hit by the Renault van as it took the turn onto Calle Pasteur and recalled glaring at it but did not get a good look at the driver. She could not say whether he was old or young, Arab-looking or not. All she could say was that he had seemed to be alone. Terrorists had struck once before. 2 years earlier, a Ford F-100 truck loaded with the high-explosive Semtex had blown up in front of the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires and killed 29 people. The truck had been bought in Ciudad del Este with $100 bills reportedly traced to a currency exchange house in Lebanon that belonged to Manzer El-Kassar, an infamous arms dealer. By the way, before we continue with the next section, which deals with Manzer El-Kassar, some of his activities in Latin America, El-Kassar is someone we've dealt with at great length in the past. We've looked at him in connection with the Iran-Contra operation. He was heavily involved both with securing East Bloc arms for use by the Contras and in securing American arms and weapons parts to be sent to the Iranians. Manzer El-Kassar, a very important fellow we've dealt with in RFA program number 32, 34, 35, and 38, as well as a number of For the Record programs, including programs number 109 and 330. Manzer El-Kassar is dealt with at great length in the book The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. Now, once again, about Manzer El-Kassar and his alleged connections to the AMIA bombing, something we looked at in FTR 109. Speaking of the F-100 truck used in the Israeli bombing, the bombing of the Israeli embassy in 1992, the truck had been bought in Ciudad del Este with $100 bills reportedly traced to a currency exchange house in Lebanon that belonged to Manzer El-Kassar, an infamous arms dealer. El-Kassar had extensive ties to the Syrian government and its intelligence apparatus and was suspected of a laundry list of illegal arms deals and terrorist acts, including the 1985 hijacking of the Achille Lauro cruise ship. He was also suspected of brokering a deal in 1989 between Argentinian President Carlos Menem and Syria, whereby the Syrians would make a $100 million campaign contribution to Menem in exchange for the sale of a nuclear reactor and an Argentinian missile system called Condor II. A bilateral pact between Syria and Iran tied both countries to the purchases. The Condor missile had a range of 1,000 kilometers and was widely considered to be superior to the Russian Scud missiles that were already available to Syria. Under heavy pressure from the United States, Menem, a close friend of the first President George Bush, who forced through a $300 million deal for Enron in Argentina, in which the company received huge tax breaks, made a goodwill visit to Israel and reneged on both the missile system and nuclear reactor sales. Critics accused him of pursuing a carnal relationship with the United States, and within months, terrorists had carried out the first of their two attacks. Menem is of Syrian descent and a controversial figure, one whom some believe to be anti-Semitic in a country known to have harbored Nazi war criminals. The scandalous accusations that swirled around him in the early to mid-1990s ranged from illegal arms trafficking to beating up his first wife, Zulima Yoma, in front of a visiting bank president to slipping a crocodile into her swimming pool. Not to be outdone, Yoma was filmed by a television crew physically expelling her husband from the presidential palace. An army assault team was required to reinstall him. When Menem's son Carlos Jr. was 10 years old, he put a loaded pistol to his father's head and threatened to pull the trigger if Menem didn't stop beating his mother. In 1995, Carlos Jr. was killed in a mysterious helicopter crash. Before we continue with the trials and tribulations of the Menem family, again, we've dealt with these bombings at considerable length in past broadcasts. FTR 109, in particular, goes into Manzer El-Kassar and Yomagate, as it was known, and the AMIA bombing. One of the things to note is that, Carlos Menem, Manzer El-Kassar, Amira Yoma, Menem's ex-wife, her brother, and also a key Argentinian intelligence operative who was in charge of an area where some of the explosives and other materials used in the AMIA bombing were staged, were all from the same tiny town in Syria, Yabrud, Syria. And bear in mind, we're talking about things that were going on in Argentina. So this is some very, very significant networking indeed. And again, Manzur El-Kassar, a man with more connections than a switchboard, as I like to say, was a principal player in the Iran-Contra affair as well. Now, about Carlos Menem and the death of his son Carlos. In 1995, Carlos Jr. was killed in a mysterious helicopter crash. Many Argentinians are convinced that the helicopter was shot down as an act of revenge, possibly for reneging on the deal with Syria and Iran. To no one's surprise, the investigation into the bombing of the Argentine-Israeli Mutual Association, known by its Spanish acronym AMIA, was bungled from the start. The crime scene was trampled by the police, rescuers, and the simply curious, and nearly all the physical evidence, including body parts of the victims, were collected in plastic bags and dropped off at an open-air dump. 3 years later, the bags were dug up and thrown into the Rio de la Plata. Nevertheless, some progress was made in the case, though in the hall of mirrors that is Argentinian politics, it was hard to tell who was a villain and who was a scapegoat. Investigators traced the white van used in the attack to Police Commissioner Juan José Rebelle, who for years had been suspected of using his position to run an extremely lucrative side business trafficking stolen cars to Paraguay. Investigators soon discovered that Rebelle had received a $2.5 million payment from an unknown source, possibly as a payoff for the crime or for taking the fall. Rebelle claimed it was an inheritance. And 66 recordings from police wiretaps of a Rebelle associate mysteriously disappeared during the investigation. In the end, 14 more policemen and 4 of their associates were arrested for the bombing. Parenthetically here, before we continue, a major connection that is to be considered in connection with the networking between Islamist terrorists and neo-Nazi and white supremacist terrorists in the United States and elsewhere concerns one of the items that we talked about in For the Record program number 109. We came back to it in FTR 330, and that is the FBI's finding that a number of the police personnel who were implicated in the AMIA bombing were members of an Argentinian cell of a white supremacist organization based in the United States called White Aryan Resistance. That organization was headed up by Tom Metzger. It included white supremacist Dennis Mahone. And it is more than a little interesting to see Argentinian personnel, police personnel, implicated in AMIA belonging to a cell of White Aryan Resistance. It has been reported by some that Timothy McVeigh had belonged to White Aryan Resistance for a time. Certainly Dennis Mahone was involved with that particular operation. His name also crops up in connection with the Oklahoma City investigation. Continuing. And it got even stranger. 15 days before the AMIA bombing, it turned out, a shadowy Brazilian named Wilson dos Santos had visited the Argentinian consulate in Milan and tried to warn officials of the upcoming attack. His girlfriend was part of the terror cell that had carried out the embassy attack in 92, he said, and they had another attack planned for a building in Buenos Aires that was, quote, under construction, unquote, the AMIA building. The Argentinian diplomats dismissed him out of hand, but after the attack he was quickly found in Brazil by none other than Mario Aguilar Risi, who had also had advanced warning of the attacks from his own sources. Risi had just been cleared of kidnapping charges and had been released from prison. While in jail, Risi says, he wrote numerous letters to Argentina's then-interior minister, Carlos Corach, as well as to a federal judge, explaining that he had deep sources in terrorist cells in Argentina, Paraguay, and Brazil, and that these cells were planning a devastating attack on the AMIA building. He was ignored, the attack occurred, and as soon as Risi was released from prison, he tracked down Dos Santos. In Brazil, he videotaped himself with Dos Santos, who made a brief statement that he was returning to Buenos Aires to tell the truth. According to Risi, Dos Santos had agreed to testify as long as his identity was not revealed. But in Buenos Aires, as soon as he made his statement to the presiding judge, Juan José Galeano, his name and photograph were leaked to the press. Dos Santos immediately recanted everything, explaining that the AMIA warning had simply been a lucky guess. Judge Claudio Bonadio threw him in jail to await trial for perjury charges. The investigation, or cover-up, blundered along for years. Its most vocal critic was the number two investigator in the case, Claudio Lifschitz. 2.5 years into the investigation, Lifschitz quit in disgust and wrote a book called AMIA, Why the Investigation Was Made to Fail. It alleged that the entire probe had been compromised in an effort by President Menem to cover up his ties to Syria and Iran. The two bombings went unsolved for years, but support for Lifschitz's accusations emerged suddenly last July when the New York Times and the Washington Post reported that a former Iranian intelligence officer, using the name Abolghasem Mezbahi and otherwise known as Witness C, had testified to Argentinian investigators that the 1992 embassy bombing was planned by a diplomat at the Iranian embassy in Buenos Aires and supervised by a senior Iranian intelligence officer. Months after the bombing, Mezbahi said, an emissary from Menem flew to Tehran to accept a $10 million payoff to cover up the first bombing, as well as any, quote, future, unquote, acts of terrorism. The money, according to Mezbahi, was deposited in a numbered Swiss bank account controlled by Menem, a fact later confirmed by Swiss investigators. By the way, in the milieu of the Triple Border area, one of the areas of networking to note is networking between Shia and Sunni Islamic terrorists. In other places, those are adversaries, but not here. And it would appear increasingly that Sunni and Shia elements are finding areas of collaboration in Iraq as well. Not a happy development. And again, as I indicated, and as we've already touched on briefly, we're also going to look at some very important indicators of networking between Western terrorist elements, neo-Nazi and white supremacist terrorist elements in the U.S. and elsewhere in particular, and some of their Islamist counterparts. And the executive authority helping to direct these, in my opinion, is the Underground Reich. Continuing. Over and over again, the AMIA investigators had come upon references to Triple Border. It's the perfect place for the Hezbollah. Deep in the Mato Grosso, or outback, near the enormous Iguacu Falls, surrounded on three sides by corrupt governments, a community of 30,000 Muslims had established itself to take advantage of the booming cross-border trade. Most are Lebanese who fled the civil war in their country, and most are decent, hard-working people, but the opportunities for illegal activities are almost infinite, and the money to be made is immense. The Lebanese influx into the area followed what Brazilian journalist Jackson Lima terms the suicidal development plans, unquote, of Brazil and Paraguay in the early 1970s. Seeking to exploit the energy-generating and tourism potential of Iguacu Falls, as well as the trade among the three countries, Lima says, government planners look to Niagara Falls, Las Vegas, and Miami as models for development. A, quote, zone of special tourism, unquote, was established where Brazilians and Argentinians, for the most part, could converge on the Paraguayan boomtown of Ciudad del Este, mainly to buy cheap electronics. We're going to continue with this article in the second side of the program. Be aware that there'll be a detailed, article-length, annotated description of For the Record 457 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com within a week or so of the airing of the broadcast. The descriptions frequently contain material that I didn't have time to include in the original broadcast. Sister station WFMU is now archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word. Older programs available for download only, also on Real Audio at a longer URL, linked to both the wfmu.org/Dave Emery address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website as well. Spitfire website contains the latest pair of half-hour segments that have been recorded. They are available for download only on Real Audio for a week or so after the original recording. And again, I've made references to other broadcasts. You can check out both the descriptions and the audio files themselves, courtesy of WFMU and the Spitfire website. That concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 457, titled Three's a Crowd, Terrorism in the Triple Border Area, being recorded on April 25th of 2004. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.